money.
Yukon and Valdez is submitted as our Exhibit 5. In addition to the soils investigation along the pipeline route, detailed soil studies have been initiated to determine optimum locations for the pumping station sites that will eventually encompass 12 stations. Our Exhibit 6 has been prepared to explain this selection process. Initially, the origin station and 4 of the 11 ultimate booster stations will be constructed. Material selection to meet the rigorous environmental requirements has been deemed as important as soil selection. The major pipeline component, line pipe, has been purchased based on rigid specifications, especially designed to meet all these requirements. Many steel makers declined to quote, citing inability to meet the rigorous requirements of the specifications. The specifications for the major components, such as valves and fittings, are equally stringent. Exhibit 7 explains the type of materials selected. As I mentioned earlier, Arctic Environmental Engineering Laboratory of the University of Alaska has been conducting research in the area of pipe stresses caused by permafrost conditions. Exhibit 8 describes this work. In addition, a program for evaluating a heated line section to provide operational data has recently been developed by Dr. Payton. This program has been authorized to proceed immediately in cooperation with the Highway Department of the State of Alaska. Pipeline control philosophy for TAPS is also simply stated: to provide an operational control system that will combine maximum safety to the environment with maximum reliability. Consistent with this philosophy, the control concepts selected by TAPS depend upon maximum automation to remove the possibility of human failure, together with a reliable communication system furnishing data and monitoring information to a centralized dispatcher where modern computer technology is employed to assist dispatchers in controlling the system. Computers are employed to provide rapid update of information, but discretion in the commands function is retained with the dispatcher. This automated control is supplemented by assigned personnel at stations along the route. Our Exhibit 9 and 10 provide a more detailed description of the control system and the station automation upon which it depends. A description of the terminal site, its method of selection, and a brief explanation of the firefighting system, oil spill protection, and ballast treating facilities is contained in Exhibit 11. Most of the comments and concerns addressed to the project have related to the environmental and ecological effects anticipated as a result of the pipeline construction and operations. In this regard, it is obvious that environmental protection is primarily dependent upon retention of soil stability and construction of a secure pipeline facility. This explains our emphasis on soil selection and evaluation as the paramount criterion in determining the pipeline route. We believe that the route selected encompasses soil conditions that with our proper engineering design, will provide a pipeline system of utmost structural integrity.
Mr. Delaney, pardon me, I'm sorry, but your 15 minutes is up. Can you conclude as soon as you can?
I think I can, very can. We have several other exhibits I'll mention quickly. Exhibit 12 outlines the basic construction techniques. Revegetation techniques and associated research are outlined in our Exhibit 13. Water resources and their protection are spoken to in our Exhibit 14. The results of an ecological survey and study are presented in our Exhibit 15. And in Exhibit 16, we have comments on the proposed stipulations prepared by the Department of Interior. I would like to say this one thing, that completion of this pipeline is essential to the development of Alaska and its natural resources. It could be completed by early 1972, and the resulting benefits to Alaska and the United States can then be obtained. We wish to assure you and the general public that this schedule can be met and that it will result in a stable pipeline with full protection to the environment. And then Dr. Pecora raised a question. I might say that Dr. Hal Payton and Mr. Melaccio will appear at your desire to speak to the issue raised by Dr. Pecora. They can appear now or they can appear later, as you might wish.
Thank you, Mr. Delaney. Do you also have a written statement that you want to put in as an exhibit?
This is it right here.
Now, for the record then,
Mr. Delaney, Dr. Glasgow would have a question at this point.
I would like to address a question to you, similar to the one that I addressed to the Alaskan delegation, and that is this. Does TAPS plan to provide supervision to subcontractors to ensure the compliance with stipulations, state or federal, are gained?
Dr. Glasgow, it's customary in the pipeline industry under construction, regardless of its magnitude, for the owner to maintain close supervision over the performance of the contractor and his subcontractors. We would consider whatever stipulations may become a part of the permit to be a necessary part of our responsibility for supervision.
Thank you.
Mr. Delaney, we will mark your statement as exhibit number 8 and your exhibit 1 as exhibit number 9. Your exhibit 2 is exhibit number 10. And chronologically, through in that order, with your exhibit number 16 being marked exhibit number 24. Thank you, Mr. Delaney. Does the panel wish to hear from Dr. Payton and Dr. Melaccio at this time in answer to Dr. Pecora's comments?
I think chronologically, this seems to be the time, and I would guess that this is really the crucial issue before all of us. The one question I have is, I think Dr. Max Brewer is here and wishes to address himself to the same subject. And I don't want to break up the TAPS presentation. I'm trying to keep the same subject in one place in the record if we can. Mr. Delaney, would you have any objection to your two witnesses coming on now to be followed by Dr. Brewer at that point?
No, sir. I think that
would right,
be
well.
Your preference, or we could do it the other way around.
Well, let's proceed that way then. Is Dr. Brewer in the room? Would you be ready to come on then at following their presentation? Thank you.
Who do you wish to present first, Mr. Delaney, Dr. Payton or Dr. Melaccio?
Dr. Payton.
Dr. Payton, please. you state your full name for the record and spell it?
My name is Harold R. Payton, P-E-Y-T-O-N, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm not certain, as I listened to Dr. Pecora, that I understood completely and thoroughly what he said. But my understanding is that in areas where there was permafrost melt, that the geological survey at this time is seriously questioning the security of a pipeline buried. I might, in preface, say that this concept has, and the problems associated with such problems of permafrost melt have been in the forefront of virtually every aspect of establishing the design criteria for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Myself, personally, have been involved in working in Alaska in permafrost since 1953, so it is nothing new to me particularly. Conceptually, when we started on the project a little over a year ago, our recommendations to Trans-Alaska were to refrigerate the oil, send refrigerated oil down the line, and essentially build more permafrost and retain all behind us as a design concept. The principal reason for this is the ultra-sensitivity of Central Alaska and the permafrost retention in Central Alaska because of its high inherent soil temperatures. As we began to see more and more of the magnitude of this project, we found that our intuition as engineers was not nearly as good as it had been in the past on projects as much smaller scope. And I found, after running extensive calculations, that it was impossible in any practical sense to refrigerate oil on the North Coast, ship it through Central Alaska, essentially refrigerating Central Alaska, and on to Valdez. The concept then had to be one of transporting oil which was above the freezing point of water. And the question then is how to accomplish this with the maximum pipeline security. And as Mr. Delaney said, maximum pipeline security is indeed the prerequisite of everything involved in design criteria. Now, we've looked at calculations on how much permafrost melt there is going to be in great detail, and our numbers are much greater than yours, Dr. Pecora. My calculations show thaw bulbs in the order of 200 feet in diameter over the great bulk of the line in full production at the 2 million barrel a day throughput. This meant then that we had to pay very careful attention to the soils that we were going through, and the whole drilling program and the enormous manpower effort and money effort that's been expended in route analysis has been toward the selection of soils which have virtually no ice in them, such that when they have elevated temperature, there's no settlement, there's thermal degradation, but nothing more than an increase in temperature. And we find that the great part of the line is in soils which have virtually no ice content above that of the natural voids, either in gravels, broken rock, as most of the route north of the Yukon toward Wiseman, a great amount of rock and gravels across the Tanana Valley and up through the Delta River country. So, except for isolated locations, all high ice content frozen soils, which could experience settlement when thawing, have simply been sidestepped by a very careful route analysis. And this in itself constitutes the greatest portion of why Trans-Alaska is confident in saying that most of the line will be buried. Then I think maybe where there may be some difference of opinion or in some small remaining areas in which our analysis says that if we can found the pipe on very competent soils such that when the permafrost is melted that the line experiences no settlement or no differential settlement, that we can tolerate substantial settlement of the soils above the pipe. If very careful precaution is taken for subsequent hydraulic erosion, and without going into the details, this is certainly under consideration, problems of buoyancy, and we can talk for hours about engineering details. I think there's some question about Copper River Valley, and at our point in time now, and with a detailed soils analysis we've made in there, with more coming, we feel that the differential settlement and settlement through the Copper River Basin is well within the capability of handling any erosion that might be potential. We don't feel that there's going to be a whole lot of settlement at all in there at this time, and that pipe stresses are going to be well below the elastic design limit, let alone, I mean, this is way, way below pipeline rupture. I mean, we're talking about a very, very conservative design. In closing, I would like to say that I'm more than willing to meet at any time, any place with your people and discuss this in great detail.
Did you have any questions?
No, merely to confirm that we'd like to talk more.
Well, we certainly look forward to the opportunity of working closely with you.
Thank you, Dr. Payton. Dr. Malecho?
Will you please give the reporter your name and please spell it?
My name is Ralph Malachi. It's spelled M-I-G-L-I-A-C-C-I-O. And that is not Dr. Malachi by any stretch of the imagination. Mr. Secretary and members of the panel, this is an ad-libbed statement. And in responding to Mr. Pecora's comments with respect to permafrost melt, this is, of course, a recognized situation. And we do not wish to attempt to convince anyone that we are going to prevent thaw of the permafrost. And as Dr. Payton said, the thaw will, in fact, be extensive. But what we do wish to state is that there are a number of types of permafrost, and not all of these are detrimental to any kind of construction. And by this, I refer to low moisture content gravel, for instance, as being a non-detrimental soil type. On the opposite extreme is the extreme saturated ice-rich silt, which is the type of situation which we are trying to avoid in all situations. The other, of course, it would be bedrock, which, if frozen or thawed, presents very little difference from a pipeline standpoint, with the exception that all of these things are extremely difficult to excavate. In addition, the non-frozen soils exist at periodic points along the entire route, even in the zone of so-called continuous permafrost. And this is one of the basic reasons why the line is located so close to the Sagavanirktok River. We have found in analyzing something on the order of 400 soil borings between the Yukon River and Prudhoe Bay that the vast majority of the pipeline from Wiseman, let's say, to Prudhoe Bay can in fact be founded either in ice pore frozen gravels, in thawed gravels in the river floodplain itself, or on bedrock. Now, we recognize that in the Arctic plain and in places in the Arctic foothills, there are in fact extensive deposits of ice-rich frozen silt in which you simply could not bury a heated pipeline without experiencing extreme differential and detrimental settlement in addition to thermal erosion. And the criteria which we have used here, which is well detailed in one of the exhibits, is that we must put the pipeline on a stable or firm foundation material. Now, it can be overlain by ice-rich material, but this has no effect on the stability of the pipeline with respect to differential settlement, and this is a situation which we're trying to work around at this time. Now, we have paid extreme close attention to moisture contents in all of the types of soils which we have encountered. In addition, we have received at this point something like 300 additional borings from the Atlantic Richfield Company, which were made several years back during their seismic studies in the Arctic Plain and the Arctic foothills. These borings being on the order of 120 feet deep and logged appropriately so that we can tell what type of a soil situation in which we're dealing. Now, in all cases of the route selection from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, we've made every effort to locate the pipeline in a situation where it would be either in, on, or extremely near low ice content soils, preferably granular, so that when thaw does occur, we have a rather insignificant situation with respect to the thawed granular material, recognizing, of course, that fine-grained soils, ice-laden, undergo severe degradation when they're thawed. In addition, we have attempted to keep the pipeline in, on, or near bedrock, wherever bedrock was available, and this is the situation basically between the Yukon River and Big Delta. The line is held to high, well-drained ground, where we have found bedrock to be reasonably close to ground surface. And this is well illustrated as you look at the roads in the Fairbanks area, the ones that lead towards Livengood, the radar sites being on the hilltops in primarily dry, fine-grained soils very near bedrock. And they have performed, in fact, admirably well. And we feel this will be the same situation with a heated pipe. We've avoided areas, wherever possible, of severe solifluction, of avalanching problems, any type of slope stability problem, as should be indicative in the route selection through the Copper River Basin, for instance, where a considerable effort has been made to route the pipeline away from the highway location, which has been considerably unstable over a matter of years, recognizing that these bluffs have to be dealt with. Now, another factor has been the gravel availability. We've tried to locate the line wherever possible, where the gravels for construction of the highway or the road to the North Slope would be immediately available. And the same thing holds true for pumping stations. As far as we are able to determine, we can place pumping stations in a manner which will be suitable to the terrain and the environment. I think basically this covers all I had to say at this point, unless there were questions from members of the panel.
You stated that the you made the comment that on the line from Big Delta to the Yukon River that it goes over well-drained soils. Is this true on the north exposures of these hills?
The way the north exposures are handled, and certainly when you get on top of a ridge, you always have to get up there or you have to get down. And the way this is being handled, we recognize that north-facing slopes, in general, are those where the detrimental situations exist. And these situations are recognized. We don't feel that the north-facing slopes represent a good situation. What we're trying to do in those cases is to cross the terrain contours at right angles rather than paralleling a side hill, for instance, or following the contour in an effort to eliminate as far as is possible the effect of hydraulic or thermal erosion.
Mr. Eliasio. Excuse me. I think, of course, we all recognize that in setting the structure, one should avoid the danger spots. And we recognize also that selection of bedrock is the optimum condition. However, in your classification, as was the classification before the presentation, at the presentation before the North Commission, in the three categories of gravel, silt, and bedrock, I'm at loss as to where sand or mud is placed within this classification, because in so many areas, such as in the Copper River Basin, there is a vast expanse of lacustrine deposits, which we normally would not class as gravel or as bedrock, and hence a problem is presented. I don't believe it was the intent, as expressed earlier, that this should be, that it, for this linear distance, the pipeline would be placed above ground. I'm sure that our technical people have been talking with you and your colleagues, and we would like to continue this very close discussion, because we do have a common technical problem that we are all seeking to resolve.
Quite right, and my only comment there, Dr. Pecora, was that We have, in fact, been talking with Mr. Farians and members of your staff, and we are fully cognizant of the situation in the Copper River Basin, and in fact that they are frozen clays and silts and various mixtures, etc. So that this is definitely under firm consideration, and we do plan further exploration in the Copper River Basin.
Are there any further questions from the panel? Thank you, Mr. Malachko. The next witness then is Dr. Max Brewer. Your name and spell it for the reporter, please.
Max C. Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R. Mr. Secretary, members of the panel, I appreciate very much being invited to comment on this subject of great interest to Alaska. I have been privileged to have been able to talk to many of the people and the government task forces, the both federal and state, and industry. And I have been impressed with the intensity and the depth of thought of these individuals. I wonder at times when I hear of controversy concerning the pipeline as to whether if we had a combination of all those with expertise in the federal, in the state, and in industry, if we would have sufficient expertise to design the line to give maximum benefit to both the natural environment and to the stockholders. Good engineering up here serves both. And the thing that I would like to stress is good engineering. Many people have been working very hard. And the last two witnesses put their finger on the subject. Dr. Pecora assisted them, but frozen water and what happens to it when it melts is the problem. There are several areas up here that are vastly different and require a vastly different approach. For instance, the cold permafrost of the North Slope is vastly different from the permafrost in the Yukon area. When we start erosion on the North Slope, it is extremely difficult to revegetate it. The permafrost in the Yukon, Tanana, Copper River country is much warmer, and from that standpoint is even more fragile than the permafrost on the North Slope. However, when you come south of the Brooks Range, you have a longer growing season. You have more of a chance to revegetate, to cover some of the problems. And I think if we design for 800 miles of pipe as though it were going across the prairies of Canada or the Middle West, that we're missing part of the very real problem. Testimony of the last two witnesses has indicated an awareness On the other hand, the data that have been accumulated over the past 20 years should be added to what has been accumulated the last 2 years. And cooperation between all those who have worked on the subject arrived at in order to give us the best engineering job. And if we properly engineer so that we will not get tremendous mechanical erosion following the melting of the ice, we will have a job that will cause the least pain to those people who do not want to disturb the environment. Thank you.
Dr. Brewer, I think it might be helpful if you could identify yourself for the record and state your affiliation, if any.
I am director of the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory at Barrow. I spent 6 years there working on permafrost for the Geological Survey in the early 50s and have been director of the laboratory for the past 13 years.
Does the panel have any questions of Dr. Brewer?
Any questions?
Yes.
I address the question of Dr. Brewer. In speaking of the preservation of the environment, one tends to separate that problem from the, quote, structural integrity of the pipeline itself, quote. In the consideration of the validity of the structural design, one is considering breakage and the effects of breakage and the effects on the economics of the entire system, so that all of us are rightly concerned in the proper engineering construction compatible with this environment for structural reasons. I'd like to address a question to you, Dr. Brewer, because I don't believe you commented on it in any depth. Would you anticipate in this kind of an environment that disruption of the permafrost would or could cause erosional damage of a character that would endanger the structural integrity of the pipeline itself?
It depends on the moisture content. There are numerous areas on both, well, wherever you have topography, that if the ice content is sufficiently high, that we could expect to see buried pipe free swinging in the air for lengths perhaps 100, 200 feet. And this is the mechanical erosion that I referred to. I personally think that the greatest problem on the whole line is how much ice is in the top 20 feet of whatever material is crossed over or through.
Thank you very much.
Before you leave, I would just like to say that I think that the suggestion you have made that a cooperative kind of a working group be constituted to deal with this particularly critical problem is an excellent one. I think we have been doing it rather informally. I would like to perhaps make it somewhat more formal to emphasize the need, and I will ask Dr. Pecora, and he just told me okay, so I will direct Dr. Pecora to constitute a working group representative of industry, the state, federal government, and any private organizations and individuals with particular expertise in this area of permafrost, soil stability, design integrity that we've been talking about. And I would like to suggest that since some of the obvious members of such a group are here and now in this room, that the first working session of that group be sometime today. Now, just exactly when we're going to leave you time to do this, Bill, I don't know, but before these various people get away from Fairbanks, I think it'd be very useful to call them together and see what progress can be made on dealing with this very serious problem. Thank you very much, Dr. Brewer.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. The next witness to be called in is Dr. Edgar Wayburn, Vice President, Sierra Club.
Secretary Train, Secretary Glasgow, members of the panel, Mr. Chairman. My name is Edgar Wayburn. I am a physician, which is beside the point, and a conservationist, which is to the point, in my being here today. Coming at this moment in the hearings, I feel a little like a Martian landing at an idealized conference of the United Nations. In fact, I believe in this room, as well as in the United Nations, there are conflicting opinions. I am Vice President of the Sierra Club. My home is in San Francisco. I learned of this meeting when I was traveling in Alaska. At the time, I was in Anchorage. I've spent quite a few weeks during the past 3 years traveling, seeing, listening extensively to Alaskans from all over the state of Alaska. As a matter of fact, I've traveled from Ketchikan to Point Barrow in Prudhoe Bay, from the Canadian border to Nome and Kotzebue and Dillingham, in trying to find out about Alaska and Alaskans. The issue of the pipeline, I believe, is one of the most important resource issues which will face this federal administration. It is a national issue. It involves the public good. The Sierra Club, as a national organization, requests permission to make a statement on the national issue in Washington, D.C., where I understand hearings will be held in about a month's time. Today, I'm going to call on our Alaska chapter, which has grown from under 100 members to nearly 400 members in the past 2 years. As an important conservation group in Alaska, they will make the Sierra Club's first official statement on the proposed pipeline, the application for it, and the proposed stipulations. But before calling on Mr. Hans van der Laan, who will present the chapter's views, I would like to comment informally following a first-hand inspection of the proposed pipeline route north of Fairbanks, and after personal discussion with a large number of people who live in Alaska, and particularly in the Arctic, some of them year-round, as well as with people concerned with taps. I've spoken with a number of people at the meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and I've heard some interesting papers concerning it. I've also talked informally with a number of scientists and engineers who've raised disquieting questions, and I may say without reservation, I am not reassured. I've not heard satisfactory answers to too many important questions. For example, as you've heard already this morning, What will be the effect of permafrost on the pipeline in different parts of its route? What will be the effect of earthquakes on the pipeline? What will be the effect of the pipeline on the permafrost and on the mountain areas through which it must traverse? How many transportation corridors should there be to the north? And should the pipeline have exclusive jurisdiction over determining where a transportation corridor should be? I want to assure Mr. Delaney that preservation and the pipeline are not synonymous, despite all the good intentions in the world. The pipeline is not a garden hose to be laid in place. It will necessarily involve disruption of the earth over a very large swathe of this state. I'm happy to hear Governor Miller and all of the other state officials desire to protect this land. I suggest that as they have presented this, they have not yet the capacity to do so. And it will take time to develop this capacity. And for this, I refer you to their own testimony. This pipeline will be an unprecedented experiment. For it to be successful, there should be adequate preparation before and not after the construction is begun. The United States' successful experiment in putting a man on the moon was actually undertaken after a great many controlled experiments over a period of many years. The United States' exploitation of its last great undeveloped area should have similar controls. Therefore, I believe it is in the national public interest, as well as in the state's interest, to oppose granting of this permit, and I do so. If, however, the application should be granted in the future, after much more is known and taken into account, I believe it is definitely in the public interest to have careful and stringent stipulations such as those already proposed by the Department of the Interior. I will now turn the Sierra Club statement over to our Alaska chapter. I hope that you can give them full time. I also wish to place in the record the remarks which I made 2 days ago to the 20th conference of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Fairbanks. Thank you.
Your remarks, Dr. Wayburn, will be marked as exhibit number 25. Does the panel have any objection to calling Mr. Hans Vanderland at this time and giving him the full 15-minute period?
No objection.
Thank you, Dr. Wayburn. Mr. Hans Vanderland then will be the next witness.
I might say that we hope to recess at 12:30 for lunch until 2 o'clock.
Thank you. Will you give the reporter your name and please spell it?
My name is Hans Vanderland. H-A-N-S, V-A-N, V, like in victory, A-N, D-E-R, capital L-A-A-N.
Might try to leave a little time for questions so we could still break up at 12:30 if that'd be possible.
I'll try to make it fairly short. I represent the Alaska chapter of the Sierra Club. I do this in the position of the conservation chairman. The Alaska chapter of the Sierra Club opposes the granting of the permit for the proposed pipeline. The Alaska chapter of the Sierra Club was formed less than 1 year ago because of our concern over the poorly planned development pressure on Alaska's natural environment. 2 years ago, prior to the formation of the chapter, our membership was less than 100. Today, our membership throughout the state is over 400, a gain of approximately 300%. We're also proud that of the 80,000 members of the Sierra Club, our Alaska chapter has the largest state per capita membership. The abiding interest of our membership has been in preserving the high quality of Alaska's environment. It is our basic belief that the quality of human life relates directly to the quality of the environment in which man lives. And high quality in that environment requires preservation and conservation of its central components in their natural state: clean air, pure water, the absence of refuse and other pollutants, and an abundance of wildlife and natural scenic beauty. We should note that concern over the quality of American life and American environment is currently reflected in legislative proposals before the state and federal governments, as well as being a subject of widespread discussion throughout the nation. Here in Alaska is an opportunity for Americans to achieve what has been so tragic a failure elsewhere, the maintenance of a natural environment of the highest quality. But with increasing development of our natural resources, the pressure on our unique environment is accelerating alarmingly. After careful consideration of the many problems which have accumulated in the present rush for development of the petroleum resource of the North Slope, we've concluded that the most complicating factor is an absence of a well-planned development policy for Alaska and the Arctic. There is an urgent necessity to conduct long-term ecological studies to determine the effects of oil development operations generally and of the pipeline construction as proposed. We believe that the pipeline impact studies, which have already been done, are too preliminary in nature to allow the formulation of definitive policy. We note Governor Miller's claim that the state of Alaska can adequately supervise these developments, and ideally, the state should provide leadership in the study and evaluation programs. In our view, however, the state's record with respect to comprehensive resources development planning and management is badly lacking. As an example, witness the thousands of miles of geophysical trails which are still being bulldozed indiscriminately through magnificent forests, streams, meadows, and tundra, and witness the lesser but irreparable havoc caused by unregulated mining practices. All transportation routes and systems should be integrated for movement of materials north and south and throughout the state. The winter haul roads, which now exist, the proposed railroad extension, the proposed pipeline route across the state, and possible future pipeline systems should be coordinated and planned for minimum impact on our environment. Adequate provisions for the protection of key wildlife, scenic, and wilderness areas have not yet been made. Areas such as caribou herd calving grounds, as yet undesignated bird and wildlife sanctuaries, and the many unique scenic areas worthy of park or wilderness designation should be protected from all exploitation. It is claimed that the earth will rejuvenate itself or that it will be reconstituted with minimum damage, but such a claim is neither proof nor even evidence and may indeed be wishful thinking. As noted earlier, the studies thus far instituted on the various phases of the proposed pipeline have been underway for time periods completely inadequate toward establishing the data necessary for reaching valid scientific conclusions as to construction requirements. It is obvious that the stipulations of the Bureau of Land Management were drawn up in premature fashion, though the task was accomplished so valiantly under conditions of great pressure, and the Bureau of Land Management is to be complimented on its efforts. Indeed, because of the premature and incomplete character of all the studies, conclusions, and solutions as to the problems attendant to the construction of this pipeline, it is impossible to know at this time just what the true requirements are. We believe that the Bureau of Land Management must know a great deal more before it can act responsibly in this new realm of oil pipeline construction in Alaska. If these considerations are valid, then they also argue go slow on committing the land and the people of Alaska to such a tremendous project at this time. We're not insensitive to the short-run economic costs of delay, nor to the desired and very necessary improvements in the economic and social situations of Alaska. But it is apparent that hasty, premature construction of a pipeline of such magnitude may permanently cheat all Alaskans by doing irreparable harm to the natural environment. It's for all these reasons, and because we in the Alaska chapter of the Sierra Club believe that Alaskans truly hold this last great land in trust for all Americans, that we oppose granting of permits for the proposed pipeline, and that we respectfully request the Interior Department, in conjunction with the state, to proceed with further studies and planning for an eventual determination of producing the North Slope oil with the least possible impact to our natural environment. We thank you for holding these public hearings on this important matter and very much do appreciate this time to testify.
Thank you very much. Question? Mr. Ryan.
You indicated a feeling for additional study. I think there's been a lot of discourse here on the fact that additional knowledge is needed. Did you have any particular thing in mind?
There are various areas. The ecological studies along the pipeline route, which have been made, including those which have been made by TAPS, have been fairly short time studies. They have been not completed prior to the drawing up of the stipulations. We feel that it's absolutely necessary that all such studies be done over a meaningful period of time and that the stipulations then be drawn up. There are other areas which need protection and against complete or against any exploitation, such as areas such as setting aside Gates of the Arctic National Park and other areas which need study and definition so that we can develop this land in overall policy.
Chairman, may I address a question to the witness? Earlier witnesses have discussed the importance of engineering geology in the structural consideration of the pipeline route and mechanics of the device itself. I note that you have stated that your chapter opposes the granting of the permit. Did you have the benefit within your chapter of any expertise in the field of engineering geology, or has your stated opposition been based entirely on the biological environmental characteristics?
There are geologists, there are engineers, and biologists within our chapter. All these people have had a voice in drawing up this conclusion.
Have you received any reports of a technical nature in the area of terrain analysis, engineering characteristics, geologic evaluations? If so, we would be happy to have them made available for our study group.
We have not received reports which are not available otherwise to the BLM.
Is it your opinion that your chapter would view with acceptance the task force directed by the Undersecretary in attempt to pull together all of the technical information and brain power possible to evaluate this problem in its right context? Are you in favor of the task force as such?
Yes, we are.
And would you be willing to recognize that such a group has as its primary mission a determination of identity of problems and potential solutions?
Would you repeat?
Do you think this is a good idea?
I think the approach is excellent in that, yes, I do.
I want to bite before we start.
Bert?
Thank you, Mr. Vanderlaan. I've been informed that there are no facilities available for lunch here at the university, with the exception of a snack bar at Constitution Hall. The hearing will be in recess at this time, and we will convene again at 2:00. The technician for the university, who is also recording the proceedings, has asked that all witnesses speak close
into the microphone, and also that the members of the panel speak closer into the microphone. The first witness this afternoon is Harry Porter, acting mayor, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Secretary, members of the panel, committee. I just found out this morning that my occupation is thermal degradation. We're in the heating business. We do everything we can to combat the frost for about 9 months of the year here. And we're not even too sure we're not in favor of the man that suggested diking the Arctic Ocean and trapping the Japanese current for the permanent thermal degradation of the Arctic. However, be that as it may, we'll try to impart to you in this short time that we have something of the feelings of the people of this community. We are not Arctic experts. I offer the testimony that I do offer with unanimous consent of the City Council and in behalf of the citizens of our city. I cannot say their unanimous consent as far as the citizenry is concerned, because their opinions vary from those who agree with me to those that wish they'd never heard of oil or Washington, D.C. or pipelines. I can say for that citizenry right now that I wished every one of them could grow a new rack every season. If they could grow a new rack every season, maybe we could get some of this study money and help to do something about our problems here in this community of 60,000. We about got washed away along with the rest of the ecology 2 years ago, and we're struggling hard to get study money and construction monies to build a flood control program. If the definitions that I've been hearing of ecology are correct, then our interrelationship with this particular environment, or this 60,000 people, ought to be important to somebody. And like I say, if we could grow a new rack every year, maybe we could enlist the help of the Sierra Society or some of the others to see if we couldn't get some flood control. We do feel strongly that though we are not Arctic experts, that 10-year, 20-year, 30-year, and 40-year residents of interior Alaska do have some qualifications to state what might work and what might be good for Alaska, both in respect to economics, ecology, and transportation. I was glad to hear people such as Max Brewer and Hal Payton testify this morning. They have the proper educational credentials. In addition to that, they've lived here with their feet in the permafrost. They've built homes here and so on. We submit and we beg you to avail yourselves of those people. There's probably more genuine, practical Arctic knowledge on transportation and its effect on ecology residing in Fairbanks and environs and living, working human beings right today than is possessed in the textbooks up to this point. We would like you to talk to people like Erling Nestlin and John Clark, the Miskovich brothers, and Walt Glavinovich, and Dick Denver, Bobby Miller, Jim Dalton, Jim McGoffin, Earl Beislein, the Weens, and I had Max Brewer's name written down here, Howard Bayless, and many more whose Arctic acquaintance is intimate. If we truly want to learn what will work there, these people are here. There's no reason to ignore the help that they could be to a group such as yourselves. We saw the military do that for years. They wondered how you ought to dress in the Arctic, and they spent a veritable federal fortune trying to find out how to dress in the Arctic. And after about 25 or 30 years, they dress about like the Eskimo does. It works pretty good. Have these people tell you how the Navy operated in Petroleum Reserve Number 4. Have them tell you how rigs were dragged bodily in the summer through the tundra, tearing it about 18 inches deep down to solid permafrost. It couldn't tear any deeper then. Then don't ask anyone, but go see for yourselves what that damaging evidence is. See if there's any evidence left of that. Inquire into the methods used in building the Dew Line, the White Alice system, and innumerable military installations. I'm not intimating that those things were all done correctly. Far from it. But I ask you now to take a look and see if there was lasting damage. And not only yourselves, but these other people that are so vitally interested in what happens up here. Have them go look and see what damage it did. There are several of us that maintain that you couldn't overcome the Arctic ecology if you wanted to. Maybe you're lucky that your problem is not to overcome it, because there are many of us that believe that you couldn't. Particularly if you leave your guns at home, we feel that they wreak a far worse damage than the bulldozer. I was aware this morning of some of the comments that were made about what the success was of protecting our ecology during the federal government's days of holding full sway over it. Someone seemed to be a little bit more polite than I am inclined to be about the fishing that was done in those days. We tried for years to eliminate the fish traps that take every bit of the fish, irrespective of species and so on. We tried without avail to eliminate that, and were only able to eliminate it after state control was given to these things. It was one of the first acts that we did after achieving statehood was to eliminate the fish traps that the federal government had allowed to continue year after year after year after year, in spite of all the pressure we could bring to bear to eliminate them. I would like to ask the members of the committee to remember, too, that this ecology that we are vitally concerned with, and I appreciate the concern, but remember, too, that only the injection of massive welfare programs, which continue until this very day, allowed some people to live in that environment. And even then, the living standard that it was capable of providing for those people is unsatisfactory to most observers, though certainly not much comment has been allowed by the recipients of those programs in these hearings. The company that I am associated with has an island in Prince William Sound. This is a beautiful place. There's crystal clear salt water. You can see 30 feet down in the salt water. There's peace and solitude and rocks and trees. If it wasn't for these hearings, I would be there right this minute. And I'm going to be there before the night's out. Now, we need the invasion of a pipeline and tankers and people in that area like a hole in the head. However, I want to be intellectually honest enough to admit that it is going to happen. I'm just as sure as we're sitting here that someday we will see this pipeline built from the North Slope to Tidewater. I do not want to see an unnecessary delay. The people in this area do not want to see unnecessary delay. And I just, sitting here listening today, I wonder, now what can you find out by studying this thing to death? You have two choices, it would appear to me. You can bury it or you can not bury it. You can bury it one place and not bury it another place. But there isn't anything else you can do with it. You can't hang it from skyhooks. You can put it where it's already laid out to go, or you can move it over 20 miles one way, 100 miles another way. But you're not going to do a great deal with this study. There aren't, they say there are unanswered questions. Yes, there are unanswered questions. Maybe one of them is whether the caribou ought to crawl under it or jump over it. I don't know. But I do know that there are only a couple of things you can do with a pipeline if you're going to build it. I think in the first place that we're getting pretty well out of context. I've been noticing this paper they've got on this gym floor all morning.
I think that each of those sheets are about 4 feet wide. And yet you'd think we were talking about tearing up about a 200-mile wide area the way we're carrying on about it. I do not want to see it delayed. If the study will prove something, fine. If not, let's get on with it. There are some probably valid reasons for going ahead and studying a little further in some respects. I wonder maybe if the reference to a corridor, pipeline, railroad, and road might not intend to shift the alignment of it. Maybe the terminus isn't meant to be Valdez. Certainly, you couldn't ruin the harbor at Anchorage with the mud and garbage that's in it. And you might ruin one at Valdez. But I hope that this isn't the reason for any of the delays. Those people down there were more than willing to take the ecological risks when they pushed for the development of that oil patch in that area, even to the point of putting it in the Kenai Moose Range. It was suggested this morning that this commission take a little look at the Delane Road to see what we had done there. As long as they're interested in education, I would like them to take a look, too, at the 47-inch Davidson ditch pipe north of Fairbanks. It's been there for many years. Take a look at the 8-inch line from Fairbanks to Haines. And stop and ask yourself a question. How long will it be before the 48-inch pipeline we're talking about now isn't reclaimed to cover by Mother Nature the same as it was over the 47-inch line or over the 8-inch line? The 8-inch line is virtually impossible to find without the markers that they've put on it, and it's a very young line. And be careful about how you answer as to how long you think it'll take it to reclaim it. Within spitting distance of this building, practically, we have tailing piles, probably an example of the worst possible way that you should leave a country after taking out a mineral. But in spite of no control and no attempt to make it different, the birch and the willow is reclaiming that rapidly. And you can physically go see it. It also turns out that it's one of the best building sites now in this particular area because rock has been brought to the top and the permafrost has been permanently done away with. I'm still a little bit confused, though. When we first objected to this study, because we felt that it might be just a delay, we voiced our disapproval to the Department of the Interior and some of the Congressional Committee. I have two letters here, one from the Department of the Interior and one from a Senate office, assuring us that the study was only to find out what would be the best for transportation in Alaska. And I prepared my remarks accordingly, that it had nothing to do with the pipeline, that the pipeline right away would be granted just as quickly as all questions were answered. These two letters tell me that. And so I honestly thought, Under Secretary Train, that the reason for this hearing today was to decide what the North wanted in the way of transportation and what it needed. And the remainder of my remarks were drafted in that light. Enough of pipelines. It is just possible this study is a serious undertaking to discover our transportation needs. If so, wonderful. Just don't hold up the pipeline by any vague references to studies and ecologies. Just make a fair, impartial study of the north half of Alaska and its transportation needs. Please do not, as some commissions have in the past, start with your mind made up with a concluded concept and then attempt to prove it. We ask you not to advocate an airport or airports unless you can show there are planes, people, and freight to use them. We think you can prove it. Do not advocate roads unless you show that there are vehicles, freight, and people that desire them. Ask Woody Johansson how long it takes homesteaders to build along a new road. See how people have pushed roads further out at their own expense to create opportunities in Alaska. You can prove these things. You can find them out. Don't advocate a railroad unless you can find trains, freight, and people that want one. When you find them, name them. If it is only Kennecott Copper, say so. If you see any parallel in what happened to a railroad north and a railroad